Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Rob Mohl, popular speaker and writer who has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes.com, Dow Theory Forecast, Books and Culture, Leadership Journal, and many other publications. But it is not just articles he has penned. There are books as well, including The Art of Dying, Living Fully into the Life to Come, and What Your Body Knows About God, a foray into the interesting world of faith and neuroscience that was just released by InterVarsity Press. We will link to those works and more interesting tidbits and bites on our webpage as we always do. So stop by, say hello to us, and check out what Rob Mohl is writing. Rob, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you.
We want to talk today about your new book, What Your Body Knows About God, which looks at the interesting connection between what John, in the Gospel of John, called the spirit and the flesh. And indeed, you actually start out your book by referencing John 3:6, but it isn't that biblical passage specifically that brought you to this point about writing about the mind-body connection or the connection between spirituality and neuroscience. Instead, you came through this topic through your previous work on your book about death and also some interesting jobs that you held when you were younger. Tell us about how you got to this book through your other book and through your previous employment.
I was in my 20s when I thought it would be a good idea to write a book about dying. Maybe not the smartest move as a 20-something, but...
I got to stop and pause that right there. As a 20s, most 20-somethings I know, they're in college, and they're not thinking about death at all, let alone even writing a book about it. So that's kind of an odd topic.
Yeah, it certainly was. At the time, I was an editor at Christianity Today magazine, and we were dealing with what was going on in the broader culture discussion around the Terri Schiavo debate. Terri Schiavo was someone who had some health accident and then for years was in a persistent vegetative state. I don't know if you remember all this, but her family members were divided in terms of whether or not she should be kept alive through hospital care. And that debate gained national attention. Congress debated it. It went to the Florida Supreme Court. And just that debate was an enormous cultural moment. And I was actually frustrated as an editor at an evangelical magazine. And my frustration was around the fact that all the voices that were speaking into this were either from the pro-life community, which has a lot of important things to say about the beginning of life, but which I felt wasn't necessarily the right perspective to take when somebody had been at the end of their life. So the two perspectives don't necessarily need to come from that same point of view, and then we had also lots of bioethicists, saying when do you pull the plug and kind of analyzing it from a really technical point of view. And I thought neither of these are really helpful. First of all, most of us are not going to be in a persistent vegetative state. That's not a normal situation for family members to have to deal with. And then I was also frustrated that these the pro-life community had so much to say that I felt wasn't necessarily applicable in these circumstances. So I said, well, there's got to be something, there's got to be some smarter folks talking about this in a way that matters to families, in a way that that applies the Bible into this situation. And it turned out I couldn't find really anybody.
So you started digging this on, or starting digging into this on your own, but even before you were editor at Christianity Today and reading your bio, you have a very fascinating bio, you had a very interesting job when you were younger working in a funeral home.
It was actually once I decided that I needed to write this book, and I also realized in my 20s I needed to have some firsthand experience on this, that I decided that I needed to do more than just the typical journalist interview a few people and read some books and then write about it. I wanted to, in a sense, get my hands dirty dealing with this subject. So I talked to the director at a local funeral home. I said, "What can I do to help around here, just to be present around people dealing with this issue?" And he said, "Well, you know, look, I need a guy to answer the phones at night." So I went and answer the phones meant, they would have. So when a family's expecting a death, they'll arrange things in advance with a funeral home. So they had a number of prospective clients, I suppose, who knew that they would be needing the funeral home services, and were ready to call when their family member passed away. So it was my job to answer that phone call.
Let me stop a minute. This is interesting. So your desire to examine the issues around the Terri Schiavo case more in depth led you to take a job answering phones at a funeral home at night. I mean, is it a 24-hour hotline? I've never heard of that.
So they had a 24-hour hotline, in a sense. So they had an answering service, basically, and they always wanted to have a person answer the phone, not a machine, not a recording, not just deliver a paging service or something like that. So they had an answering service that would go, I think in their case it was something like 11 at night to 5 in the morning. But then as long as they could, they wanted somebody at the funeral home to answer the phone. So it was my job from about 5 to 11, something like that, to answer the phone if someone called and needed a body removed, basically. So that was one aspect of my job. And then when we had a service at the funeral home, then I, served as an usher, made sure that stuff went smoothly, made sure people knew where to go, greeted folks at the door, and then picked up afterwards.
That's got to be a tough job. This is one of those jobs that somebody has to do, but who goes out looking for that kind of job? What did you learn doing this? I mean, actually, first of all, start with just answering the phones. I mean, I guess if I needed a body removed, the first place I wouldn't call would be the... Actually, I don't know who I would call. I mean, I've never had to have a body removed yet, so that's interesting. What was it like working on the phone bank there?
Yeah, normally, someone would call like 911 or something.
Right.
And probably that's the worst thing. In a situation where that death is coming, it's probably the worst thing that you could do, because, when 911, they're going to arrive and their job is to save a life. So that's not always – that's actually how a lot of people end up in a persistent vegetative state where they're dead and then resuscitated. And then, so my job, the tough thing was not so much that it was tough, but it was awkward. It was socially, how do you say, sure, I'll come over, I'll drop by in just a few minutes and pick up Aunt Millie.
Yeah.
It's not That, I guess, bedside manner is really what was the challenge. How do you talk to folks who are grieving? How do you have a sympathetic ear? One of the things that I learned in writing the book is, you know, we don't have those traditions anymore. Of, you know, it used to be, you know, if your wife died, you might wear a black armband over your bicep, and that let people know that you're grieving, and then that informed them that you deserve some kind of special consideration. You might just get somebody who said, you know, I'm sorry for your loss, but you'd get some kind of social recognition, which is really important. Nowadays, we've done away with those things, and so folks don't know what to do. They don't know that we don't have social norms that tell us how to behave in these circumstances. So that makes it a lot harder for people who are grieving, because we all feel awkward and we don't know what to do. And the easiest thing to do is pretend that nothing's wrong. There's nothing to recognize. So that was the hardest part of the job, is to learn how to talk to somebody who's experienced a devastating loss, and to not be weird about it, and to not be awkward or put added responsibility on that person to say, oh, don't worry about it. But just to say, you know, I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm thinking of you. I'll be praying for you. Let me know if there's anything I can do to help.
So what did you learn through that experience that then translates into your book on dying? And what's the foundations of this book?
Yeah, so I left out of The Art of Dying this quote from from the funeral director. He would say to me that, yeah, a lot of folks didn't want a big funeral. They didn't want to make a big deal out of it. They'd say, you know, this is just a body. We don't need to do anything special with it. And so you take care of the body. We're going to go to the restaurant and have a memorial, you know, memorial get together. And then that's it. And he would actually say, a little bit joking, but not so much, say, well, you know, you can pay for the funeral or you can pay for therapy and then a funeral. And so many times folks would have this attitude that this is just a body. It doesn't matter. You know, so-and-so lives on in our hearts and you know, it's just a shell. And so we don't need to do anything special. And then they would have real trouble grieving. They would have trouble getting through that grieving process, and they'd end up, you know, on a therapist's couch, and then the therapist would say, "Well, you never did the things that you need to do in order to grieve well." And so they would come back to the funeral home and say, "Is it too late to do a funeral?" And that was a theme that I discovered writing the book on dying, was that people who treated the body with some reverence, with the idea that it itself has some sacred quality to it, those people tended to do the things that were, you know, healthier in terms of the grieving process, healthier in terms of the community bonding around the widowed or widower. And that idea of the body as being sacred and the body as a spiritual object was really fascinating to me, and I just want to explore that idea further. So that's where the book, The Art of or the What Your Body Knows About God, got its start. As we looked at dying.
Yeah. So you went from the body as a deceased corpse being something special, moving it back to what is the spiritual sacred aspect of it while living.
Yeah. So how are our bodies spiritual beings? And so there's been stuff written on, spirituality of, you know, hospitality, or spirituality of eating, So that kind of thing had been covered, I thought, and then spiritual disciplines and things like that. So I wanted to look at something that hadn't quite been looked at. So maybe that's the trend. I looked at what people weren't doing around dying and what people weren't seeing about the spirituality of our bodies.
And I should also mention that you're an employee of World Vision as well. And we just last week had a discussion with somebody at World Vision about the work that that organization does. It's a faith-based organization, humanitarian-based organization. So that brings me to the next question. You must be pretty religious yourself. Did you grow up in a religious household? What's your background that you bring to both the Art of Dying book and What Your Body Knows About God book?
It was really interesting. As I started looking at the neuroscience of prayer and spirituality, what really dawned on me was that the way that I had been taught to pray growing up is at least in terms of how your brain works, is one of the most powerful ways that you can experience God and you can change your brain, how your brain's functioning. So what I mean by that is the church that I grew up in, just from as a little kid, was founded as a denomination founded in China. And if you've ever been around, you know, in Asia, and I've had a chance to visit just a couple of times, if you're at a church service in Asia, you quickly realize that these folks don't pray like we pray in church here in the U.S. We've got these nice, sweet prayers about Jesus helping us out. I remember being at a Presbyterian church in Seoul, Korea, and you know I had this image of sort of these staid Presbyterians,
as they're known, the Frozen Chosen.
That's right.
With all due respect to our Presbyterians out there in Princeton and other places, yeah.
Yes, as well as the doctrine of predestination.
Mm-hmm.
But these Korean Presbyterians, when they prayed, man, they got down to business. It was intense. It was highly, I wouldn't say charismatic, because it wasn't about speaking in tongues or any kind of Pentecostal excitement, but it was intense. It was motivated. It was deeply, deeply, it was a level of spirituality that really I'd only encountered as a kid in this Chinese background church. Now my folks are I'm Irish and German, but that tradition was filtered down to me. So I actually dedicated the book to my junior high high school youth group leaders, who really taught me to pray in an intense, focused way, and it was something that I had lost just kind of going to your typical church as I got older.
Well, let me ask you how you get involved in this church. You're Irish German heritage. You don't look Chinese at all, but you're at this Chinese church. Where? How did that happen? I mean, is it just the one down the block, or your folks said, you know, we really like the food, so let's go there? How does this work out?
I'd say that both my parents were Jesus freaks. They came to Christ, grew up Catholic, so they had a religious background. And then drifted away in their probably teen college years, and then had they were hippies and had a really powerful spiritual experience through this sort of Jesus freak movement. So church, a couple of Chinese missionaries, I suppose, came to the U.S., hit L.A. just right at the right time, and they were around when, so there's a few different outgrowths, I guess, of that Jesus movement, and one is the Calvary Chapel movement, and my folks got introduced to Christ in a new way, through this denomination.
And the other thing that's very interesting is you mentioned the Korean Presbyterians or the church that you grew up in. Our typical stereotype of someone who's Chinese or Korean is very reserved, very polite, but their spirituality very intense. That's interesting. The prayer doesn't – I'm having a hard time kind of squaring this in my head. Did you as well? Or is – I mean, you grew up in it.
I grew up with it. So it was the it was the water I swam in. And that seemed natural to me. I would say that, yeah, maybe there's a reserve or a formality with Asian cultures. But certainly I've seen with the Korean church a real intensity of personality and in the same way the Chinese folks that we knew. So I actually grew up eating kimchi on occasion. Mm-hmm. And I forgot what those little dumplings are called. We would have Sunday evening church meals, and so Chinese food was always a part of that.
So that's a very interesting background. And as you mentioned, you're working at Christianity Today. The Terry Schiavo thing comes up. You're interested in how we deal with death, and you write the book on that. Now we're at your book on spirituality and neuroscience, and you have this interesting experience to growing up of intense spirituality and how that really can affect you. You must have some idea that praying in this way, it's not just praying. There's something else is going on here. So this leads you to investigate the issue about neuroscience. I have to ask this question. Are you a brain surgeon?
No, not at all.
Okay.
The brain is incredibly complex, really, really difficult to understand. And the only ways or one of the main ways that we've learned about the brain is sticking folks in fMRI scanners. And really all you can see there is the parts of the brain that are really processing, where the blood is going, because those parts of the brain are processing. But that's studying the Earth from satellite images. So it's a really complex, the brain is maybe the most complex thing in the universe. They say there's more potential brain states than there are particles in the universe. It's an amazingly complex thing. So I'm not claiming to have a profound understanding of the brain. What I'm trying to do is take some of the main findings that have come about in the last 30 years as the brain studies have really developed, and say, how do we, especially as a Christian, how do we understand this and how do we apply it in our spiritual lives? And there's a lot that these researchers have uncovered. Not only that we can say, okay, now that we know this about the brain, maybe this is how we can say our prayers, but also the way in which a lot of these understandings of how the brain works really coincide with the ways in which the Bible teaches us to live. The Bible kind of explains human nature. There's a lot of coherence there. So I'm trying to get at that intersection.
And that is what is really cool about the book. And I had a chance to read a preview copy of it in anticipation of this interview. And it's part biology textbook, it's part biblical exegesis, it's part personal reflections on a lot of things. It's a really great read. And again, we'll point our listeners back to it. I urge you to pick it up. And the fact that you're not a brain surgeon is what is very appealing to me, because you talk to brain surgeons, they start throwing out a lot of terms that make your eyes gloss over. So you're distilling a lot of this stuff for the common folk like us who are not brain surgeons. So that's really cool. Did you find the task daunting?
At first, when I realized how crazy complex the brain is, and I thought, maybe I'm not going to be the right person for this, but I think
memories of high school biology class again, like, whoa.
Yeah, right. Thankfully I always did better in science and math than I did in English classes. So maybe that was helpful here. Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit daunting, but I'm taking a journalist approach, trying to learn from the experts. I remember talking to a Christian neuroscientist at Stanford University, and what he would do, his job was basically to put nodes into monkeys' brains and find out which neuron is the one that determines a horizontal line in your field of vision, and which one is the one that determines a vertical line. I mean, it's amazing how crazily complex your brain is. But once a manuscript is done, I shared it with some folks, and one Christian neuroscientist said, "I felt like you'd been sitting in my classes for the last 20 years."
Oh, well, very good. You get an A+.
So, yeah.
So before we get to the brain or body mind nexus, tell us a little bit about the brain. What did you learn about the brain? Because I haven't been sitting in those classes for 20 years. I don't know anything about brain science. So what were some of the things that really surprised you or stuck out at you that said, "Well, this is what the brain is."
The first thing that really stuck out to me was that it does seem that our spirituality is hardwired. A lot of folks will have said, maybe a spiritual experience is some form of epilepsy. Because there does seem to be people who have certain kinds of epilepsy. Some people who have certain kinds of epilepsy, and Dostoevsky is well known for this. There's moments in that before a seizure where it seems to they seem to have a really profound spiritual experience. So then because that happens in that case, there's an extrapolation that maybe St. Paul was an epileptic, and all these mystics were epileptics. Epilepsy is, or having a seizure is something that is not healthy for your brain, but spiritual experiences are. And when they look at the brain as someone is deeply in prayer, it looks as though the brain is healthy, is functioning in a really healthy and normal way. The brain does seem to be hardwired for a spiritual experience. So that was the one thing that really, really struck out at me. Another thing is that our conscious minds are not as in control as we feel like they are. That was just another thing that came back to me over and over again. And we think because we experience ourselves in our conscious selves, we think that we're in control in that way. But everyone who's failed to fulfill their New Year's resolutions knows how hard it is to actually be in control of who we are. And a lot of what goes on, if you want to change yourself, you need to work at the subconscious level, the level from which our consciousness arises. So that's where the real power is. And so that was kind of the second highlight that I learned as working on the book. And then the third one was that we are really powerfully connected to other people. And that's not just a social phenomenon. That's a biological one. So they've done studies, folks who get transferred into a department where people are more generous givers. Those people who transfer in become more generous as a giver. Without generosity and financial giving being at all part of work life, something is shared in that way. If you're 2 degrees separated from someone who's going through depression, you're more likely to lose some degree of happiness. Whether or not you actually know that person. So we're actually, and we can get into this when we talk about mirror neurons, but we're actually deeply deeply connected to other people. So this is kind of three main highlights that I drew from working on the book.
Well, let's dig into this book, and you divide the book up in a number of different ways, and themes are repeated throughout the book, and it's connected very well. You start talking about the individual level, specifically about what prayer can do to us in our body. We've talked to folks like Jeff Levin about this as well, and we'll link back to his podcast. And then there's what we were just talking about, that social level, which is, you know, two or three or four people together. And then you also mentioned bigger worship in, say, a mega church or in a bigger religious community, that there's also some connection between that experience and your body, your brain, etc. So let's go ahead and work through this, and let's start at the individual level. Just you as a person in a room by yourself praying, and you talk a great deal about praying here. What have neuroscientists found out about prayer?
Yeah, so when we're talking about prayer, I want to give a little bit of a definition, and we're used to, often in Christian circles, at least in the U.S., we're used to prayer being, you know, thank you, God, for this food, and bless our day, and thank you for the sunshine. Or, dear Jesus, I have this problem, will you fix it for me? And, you know, it's a couple, we say it real quickly before a meal or whatever. And when I'm talking about prayer, I guess I'd say I'm not talking about that. At least as far as neuroscience is concerned, that really doesn't have much of an effect on your brain. However, that's not the way that the Christian tradition normally teaches prayer either. And as we said earlier, when I was growing up, prayer was an intense focus on communion with God. And a lot of times that comes about through maybe you're meditating on a passage of Scripture. Maybe you are reciting prayers written that Christians have prayed for centuries. You know, the Jesus Prayer is well known, and you're using those words often as a frame or a tool to focus your mind on Jesus or on God, and you're spending a solid amount of time in prayer and focused meditation or contemplation. So you're making a real mental effort. Mm-hmm. And
by the way, you actually mentioned this in the book, that you have a practice of praying for 15 minutes. And I was kind of amazed by this, because I started reading the chapter on prayer, and I thought, okay, you know, I do that. I pick up the Our Daily Bread pamphlet, and I read through it, and it has a, you know, biblical passage to do that with a nice little story. And I do the prayer, sit down saying, okay, thank you for the gifts that you've given me, and, you know, I really need to work on this, so help me through the day, and this kind of thing. But yeah, that's a 2-minute, 3-minute process. And I felt kind of bad after reading your chapter. You're at this for 15 minutes. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, first I'd affirm, you know, the value in doing what you're doing. It's not spending time going through a passage like that. That is mental effort. So, you know, that's worthy stuff.
Okay, you make me feel good. Okay.
Neurologically, what seems to be the case is that it takes about 12 minutes of focused mental effort, repeated over a period of time, 6 to 8 weeks or something, for there to be solid long-term neurological changes in your brain. Every time you have an experience, you know, your neurons are changing in order to capture that. But to make long-term changes, at least at the neurological level, 12 minutes a day, 6 to 8 weeks seems to be the minimum for that. So I thought to myself, I learned this, and I thought, okay, well, 12 minutes. I mean, how long is that really? I can handle 12 minutes.
That's a long time. I don't know. But yeah. So how long was 12 minutes for you?
There's a great Evelyn Underhill quote that says, you try for a quarter of an hour to pray and you discover how unruly your mind is. it's amazing how difficult it can be to find that 15 minutes. And for me, lately that has been when I'm putting kids to bed. I got two boys who share a room, and I found that it's helpful if I sit in there to keep them quiet, and then they'll go right to sleep. So now I find myself sitting in the dark for about 15 minutes, and heck, why, you know, that seems to be a great time to pray. So I actually set my timer so that I'm not constantly checking how long I've gone, and then I'll recite different prayers. I'll just say the name of Jesus over and over, Lord Jesus, Lord Jesus. Or I'll say the Jesus prayer, which suddenly is escaping me. I'll say other prayers. Come, Lord Jesus, draw me to yourself. Just say something like that over and over. There are times where I'll use prayer beads, but that's mostly a tool just to keep me going. And so last night I just sat and put my phone on vibrate, sat on it, and then I just prayed that over and over. So that's kind of my routine. And I find when I'm making that routine that literally my days change. I'm thinking I'm more in touch. It feels like I'm more in touch with that spiritual side of me. I'm more in touch with God, and I'm also one of the things I discovered was when you pray, you're stimulating part of the brain involved in empathy and compassion, the anterior cingulate, and I find I'm much more capable of not getting upset with my kids when they're going nuts, as kids do, because they're kids. Yeah. I'm much more able to handle a sort of maybe a conflict or a tense situation at work. That ability of mine is enhanced when I'm spending that kind of time in prayer.
And that is a fascinating finding that I found in the book, that it does somehow physically, neuroscience, it affects your brains. One of the interesting stories that you tell in this book from Sunday, Professor Beauregard, who actually studied Carmelite nuns, who do engage in very long-term prayer. It's not just 15 minutes. I mean, they're going at this for long periods of time at different parts of the day. Different parts of their brains light up. Tell us about that.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, with the Carmelite nuns, Beauregard studied, you know, had a look at these nuns' brains in three different states. He said, you know, what is their brain at rest? What is that doing? What is their brain doing when they're thinking of union with another human being, or maybe a deep friendship with somebody? So this, you know, that's might be akin to deep prayer. So he compared rest with thinking of union with friendship, and then thinking of an experience in which someone felt union with God. Well, it turns out rest is one thing, friendship is another thing, and prayer is a different thing. It's not just that emotional parts of the brain are lighting up, but as you said, you know, the parts of the brain involved in compassion. And then another part of the brain that Beauregard found is the part of the brain, I can't give you the name here, but that is involved in orienting the body in space. So this part of the brain that, you know, is, you've got this sense of where your arm is and where your legs are, and this can be studied. I mean, people who have a stroke and that part of the brain is damaged, they literally don't know that they have, you know, their right arm. Even though it's sitting there, or maybe they can even see it. But this part of the brain is actually inhibited, or can be inhibited in deep prayer. And the belief is, well, this is what actually allows you, when that is inhibited, it can allow you to experience union with something greater than yourself, something bigger than yourself.
Kind of like an out-of-body experience?
That's not the way that they describe it. It's really and it kind of goes back to all these mystics who talk about a union with God, and this is, you know, even across religious traditions. So it's not necessarily an out of body experience where you're sort of hovering over yourself and looking down, but it's a feeling of oneness with God, maybe a oneness with the universe, depending on how you want to put your theology over that experience. But it does seem that it creates an ability to experience God more directly by inhibiting this part of the brain.
One of the other things that you noted in the prayer section as well, too, is that, and this surprised me, is the role of ritualistic prayer. And I have to admit, a little bit skeptical about that. I come from a more evangelical tradition as of late, where the prayers are a little bit more free-flowing, maybe kind of like the Talladega Nights prayer, the famous one in the movie, where you just kind of go on, almost speaking in tongues and whatever comes to you. But what you noted in your book is that ritualistic prayer and the prayer beads, or reciting the Lord's Prayer, Our Father who art in heaven. And, you know, again, I always thought, well, it just seems so routine. Does it really have any meaning? But it does have an effect.
Yeah, well, as I said, you know, the conscious part of your brain is not all in all that much control over who you are, and the ritual, having something memorized, that allows access to that subconscious aspect of your brain. And this isn't like hypnotism. This isn't like, you know, I'm come from a strongly evangelical tradition, and I understand that fear of that sort of thing. This is this just allows that prayer to get deep inside of you. It allows those words to get deep inside of you. And just because it can be ritualistic and it can be rote memory and it can be, you know, words said in vain, doesn't mean that it has to be. If you say this without meaning, well, you know, that's your own problem. But that doesn't mean that that when you say something, even if you're repeating it over and over, what you're allowing to happen is that to get really inside of who you are. It gets in your bones. You know, I'll have aspects of the Book of Common Prayer liturgy just kind of float up to me during the day. I love to end a prayer with Almighty and merciful God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, bless us and keep us. I found, we can say in Jesus' name, amen. Maybe that's where we've got some problems with rote repetition. Saying those kinds of phrases, having those at my disposal at different parts of the day, having those available to me because I've said it over and over again, is really powerful.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that you note, and it's really interesting about your book, again, you go through the neuroscience, you're explaining the anterior, or whatever you call it, and all that is in there. But you also connect this deep back into the Bible, too. And this is stuff that you point out, says, you know, Paul was kind of saying this in his letter to the Ephesians or to Romans or something. And I'm like, well, yeah.
It will be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Mm-hmm. And literally, when you're praying at this in this way, you're changing your brain. Neurons are actually growing; they're shaping. Your brain is like a muscle in that the more you use it, the more capable it gets. So, I think of the anterior cingulate and the fruits of the spirit. The anterior cingulate. This part of the brain involved in empathy and compassion and connection to other people. It also acts as a kind of a tamper on another part of the brain, the amygdala, which is kind of your center of fear and anger. And so what's fascinating is as you're in prayer and you're really stimulating this part of the brain involved in empathy, compassion, or you could say the fruits of the spirit, gentleness, meekness, kindness, long-suffering, patience, love, hope, you're tamping down that part of the brain involved in anger or hatred, fear. It's amazing, like I said, how this neuroscience correlates with what you find in the Bible.
Yeah. And the fact that it does physically change your brain, it just doesn't make you feel good for 15 minutes or maybe a few minutes after that 15 minutes. But yeah, there's the science is in there that says new neurons are growing. New parts of the brain are changing.
Right.
Wow.
Right. Well, you think of what did Jesus say with two great commandments? To love God and to love your neighbors as yourselves. And when you're praying, you're loving God, and then you're stimulating that area of the brain that allows you to love your neighbor as yourself. It's astounding.
And speaking of neighbors, that's the next aspect of your book about how the brain not only reacts to our own individual prayer, but our interconnections with other people, both in one-on-one situations, but also in larger groups as well. So tell us a little bit about this. And I find this aspect of your book very fascinating, because when we talk about religion casually with other folks, you hear a lot of people saying, well, I'm very spiritual, but I'm not religious, meaning I don't get connected with other people or other churches or, that organized religious thing. And, the prayer that we just talked about kind of deals with that spiritual self. But you're finding out that, no, actually that whole religious thing of getting connected with people, either formally within a church or informally around a dining room table, makes a big difference.
Yeah, well, when you read the Bible, you see God calling out a group of people, whether it's Jews or adding to that that Israelite community in the New Testament, and God is at work with the church, but He's at work with a community of people. We're not just saved in isolation. So there's a nice John Wesley quote. I'm going to try to remember it here, but he says something like, "There's no such thing as an individual Christian." And actually, to make Christianity an individual faith is indeed to destroy it. Something along those lines.
Yeah, I actually wrote it down because it was a very powerful quote in your book. And again, this is somebody who's not a brain surgeon,
right?
Right. This is what John Wesley 300 years ago.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago. And now neuroscience is kind of catching up to Wesley. He says, he's an old Methodist itinerant preacher, he says, Christianity is essentially a social religion. To turn it into a solitary religion is indeed to destroy it.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, well, you don't have the church as individuals. Jesus, the New Testament says, "Wherever two or more are gathered, there I am." And then, from the biological point of view, there is a powerful ability of a group of people to shape our behaviors, to shape our attitudes, to shape our beliefs. That just is not available, when you're off on your own seeking your own spiritual experiences. Certainly, we can do that, but faith is really the community living in a certain way. And living out, it's a community living out sort of it's cosmic beliefs of how the world and the universe ought to be.
And you shared an experience that you had with this in your book around a dinner table. That I thought was very interesting, because your book is not only about the science and not only about the faith, but it's about you experiencing these things altogether.
This is my childhood prayer. Is that right?
Yeah. It was around the dinner table.
Yeah. So I was a kid, and as much as I say I was taught to have these sort of intense focused prayers, we also prayed before meals and said, "Jesus, thank you for this food." And I'm a kid, and I'm not saying any kind of intense prayer. I'm guessing, I'm thinking back, but I'm, 7, 8, 9, maybe 10 years old. And just said, your average dinner time prayer. And I don't know what happened, but I just felt, close to God in a way that I hadn't before that. I actually started crying. And I wasn't really sure what was happening myself. Just I had this feeling of that God was near, and my sister asked, what's wrong with Rob? And my parents kind of provide some interpretation for me, because I wasn't really sure what was going on, except the feeling I had. And my mom says, Rob just touched the Lord there, But, that's the kind of thing that maybe you don't get when you're just sitting in your room trying to have your own spiritual experience.
And it is one of those things, and when I read that passage in your book, it is one of those things that you feel every so often at church, right? I never really thought about it, but just you, when the singing really gets going and just things are clicking or the message is just really coming across and you're swaying a little bit, there's something different. And it's not just an individual thing. It just seems like there's energy in the church. There's something there.
Right. Well, there's so much more in that moment when, as you say, you're singing and you're, maybe you've got your hands raised and your eyes closed. There's so much more going on than singing a song. So just to rattle off a few, first, church is groups of people together. And one thing that, that has, been studied by sociologists is this phenomenon of small groups. We don't have mega churches. And even I think Rick Warren says in an interview with Malcolm Gladwell, he says something about Saddleback Church being not a mega church, but just a collection of small groups. That was the kind of the impetus behind the powerful growth of the Yoido Full Gospel Church in Seoul, largest church in the world, something like 800,000 members. Well, it's all what you've done is not have a big phenomenon of the church at large, but you've got lots of little ones. So you're deeply connected to these other people. Wesley, going back to him, the Methodist movement was initially these small bands, these Wesley bands. Not really no different than our small groups or cell groups or whatever you want to call them. You're getting these people together, as we like to say, doing life together. So you've got that effect going on. So you're in the church service, you've got this deeper connection with the people around you. Well, there's also, the phenomenon of a large group of people. It's no secret that when large groups of people get together, they act in kind of a unique way, whether it's a political rally or, maybe a mob. large groups of people have a powerful effect. Right now, as we're talking, there's protests in Hong Kong. There's just a powerful effect of a significant number of people together. And that's a social effect that can be studied, you know, at a political rally or a sports stadium. Well, you add on top of that a religious meaning, the sense of an ultimate meaning, and your the ritual, whether it's, you know, praise and worship, or whether it's something more liturgical. You're as a community, you're enacting your belief. So you go through baptism, or you have communion, or maybe it's just you're raising your hands because you're acknowledging an all powerful God, and you're raising your hands, you know, connecting to Him and maybe submitting to Him. You know, these things that you're doing, enacting your belief, get at that subconscious level where the real power is in terms of changing who you are as a person. So there's just tons going on right there in a church service.
And it's interesting, too, that the science talks about how this does, again, affect people's brains. And we just actually had the light go out in our room here. So let's take a quick pause and see if we can. There we go. Oh, yes. I have not had that happen yet. Let me back up. It's interesting what the science says about this stuff, because it is that feeling, but it also has physiological and neurological effects on us. And I know that, you know, one of the interesting things, and I chuckled about this in reading your book, that there's been a couple researchers that talked about touching, and more specifically, cuddle parties. Oh, let's get together and cuddle. I had to say that because I get that as a tag now on the website. So people looking up cuddle parties will be drawn to research on religion. But what is the whole issue of just being with other people, touching other people? How does that affect the brain?
Yeah, these cuddle parties. I think that this is weird. It's weird, but an interesting and oddly intriguing idea that of people getting together, strangers getting together, just for the sake of cuddling. I think that more than anything, that says we are a touch-starved society. I think that there's a lot going on when you've got some skin-to-skin contact with another human being, where you feel that touch. Lots of neat stuff going on with and interesting studies around newborn kids. One study found when mothers were asked to spend, I think it was about 5 minutes a day for, I forget, it was 3, 5, 6 days, right after the baby's birth. So the first 5 days of a baby's life, spending 5 minutes of skin to skin contact with its mother. Over time, they found an exponential effect from this. So at first, the mothers were more interactive with doctors at regular doctor visits. They're asking more questions, more involved, more interested in their baby's welfare, more active. And then years on, they found that these kids who had maybe no more than 25 minutes of extra skin-to-skin contact in the first few days of their life, that these kids were actually had higher IQs, a statistically significant higher IQ than a control group. And it's just astounding how much we need that physical contact.
And it is interesting to think about as well, because it has huge policy consequences. And I was reading through this and thinking about the role of the family, just the being together of the parents with the child, and touch on a daily basis of that warm contact that the loving parents bring to a child. I mean, you think about movements toward getting kids earlier into childcare, where usually they're told, don't touch anybody else, stay away. It's like, kids got germs, don't touch any kids with germs. it can have a huge impact socially.
Yeah, well, you look at, you think of trying to create this super hygienic environment. You know, they studied orphanages, I think this is about a century ago. I gotta make sure I recall this right, but I think they were studying orphanages in the U.S. where they were concerned about spreading disease, and they had avoided contact. They didn't want to spread disease at this orphanage, so they're avoiding touching babies, they're avoiding kids touching each other, and these kids were dying at an alarming rate, and they could not figure out why, and it turns out they were dying from being starved of human contact. You know, my wife works for an adoption agency, and so much of the problems that arise in an orphanage are around lack of human care, contact, touch. You have real social, real developmental problems that come when you're deprived of human contact. You know, we just need to be in touch with other people.
One of the other interesting aspects of being with other people is not necessarily related to touch, but our emotional connectedness. And neuroscientists have been studying this as well. You have a chapter in your book called Monkey See, Monkey Do.
Yeah. It was actually this phenomenon of of mirror neurons was discovered as they were looking at monkeys. And what researchers were trying to do was just understand how motor neurons work. So these are the cells that kind of start the signal to actually make a movement. So they'd hooked up, you know, nodes to these neurons, and they're trying to figure out what's going on. And one day in the lab, a scientist, you know, reaches over and grabs something, and the nodes start firing, you know. So the nodes are firing in the monkey. The monkey is perfectly still, and he's trying. And so that, you know, this is like, well, why are these neurons firing when motor neurons are firing when the monkey's perfectly still? So they investigated further, basically discovered that some percentage of our motor neurons fire not only when they're signaling our bodies to move, but when you see another person making a move. So you're actually, when you're watching somebody do something, your motor neurons are doing the same thing. You're mimicking that. And so, you know, at the level of the cells in our brain, we're mimicking other people. And you can take this and look at how people interact when they're in a room talking and looking at each other. And we tend to mimic another person's facial expressions. We tend to mimic their body expressions. And when people do that, they feel better connected as in that relationship. So you can get an actor who's just told to just do whatever the other person does, and as you have a conversation, you give them, you know, doing a study, and you give them whatever excuse you need to get them in a room together. Tell the actor just do whatever this person does. Well, people will leave that situation and say, I really like that guy, or she was really interesting. It's not the way that we're connected to people. Yeah, as you said, isn't just touch, but we mimic each other as well, and that mimicking isn't just at a distance looking at each other, but it actually goes to the level of the cells in our brain.
And I find that very fascinating as I'm reflecting right now on how we're doing this podcast interview. We're actually in a room. The majority of the podcast interviews that I do are over the phone. I would say maybe about 90-92% of all the interviews we've done have been done over the phone. But I enjoy the one-on-one interviews with somebody in the room immensely more because I can actually see what people are doing. And you're talking about mimicking. You know, right now as I'm speaking, I'm using my hands. And I don't do that over the phone that often. I don't think the other person does. But when I do that, there's more connection here. You see what I'm doing that's emphasizing a point. And it does create just a different, not dynamic, I want to actually say sensation, that there is a qualitative emotional difference of having somebody in the room rather than somebody over the phone. And now that's not to say that nobody should listen to these podcasts anymore, but maybe we should do videos or something like that. But continue listening to the podcast. But it is something. I read the book. I'm like, yeah, this makes total sense. And when you combine this with the prayer and the spiritual gatherings of individuals, you can just see how this has this exponential effect of, I'm not only affecting my brains, but I'm affecting the brains and body about and health of people around me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's the management philosophy of management by walking around. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
No, I haven't.
But management by walking around. In other words, your boss's job is in part just to walk around and see, hear, be seen, be around people rather than firing off emails, do this or we need to do that. Or, anybody who's worked in an office knows email is minimally effective. Phone calls are more effective, and sitting down and talking things over with somebody is the most effective way of actually getting something done. That's all really powerful. And then, you combine that in a spiritual environment, maybe in a small group Bible study or a church Sunday school, and then a church service. And all these things kind of compound, add together to create really powerful spiritual experiences. So in this study actually done at your university, the people were saying, I need church. I need to be at that service. I'm afraid I'll miss what God has for me if I'm not at church on Sunday. It's a really powerful effect.
And that university is the University of Washington. Go Huskies, we should mention. And it is surprising. I didn't even know that there was somebody at my university doing this. I guess I need to do more face-to-face meetings because I tend to be one of those email people. I go crawl away in my den and do things email-wise. And maybe that's not the most effective way, and maybe I'm cheating my mind and body and my spirit a little bit. I'm cheating them a little bit.
Well, the value of a professional conference, I'm sure.
Really? Okay. Yeah, I'm sure they're good.
Being around, I enjoy opportunities. I was just at a religion news writers conference, and having a chance to be around folks in the same field, talk to folks dealing with the same things. It's a really great opportunity I found. You connect with other people, you understand better what they're doing, and there's no way to replace that, in a virtual conference. You can raise the question, how effective are, multi-site church campuses are when you're watching the pastor on a video screen? Mm-hmm. how effective is that compared to having a pastor who's standing beside you and shaking your hand when you leave?
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting point. We're near the end of our time here, and I always like to ask my authors about, or my guests and authors, about what they learned throughout this entire process. And I just have to do a little personal reflection here too, is as you're talking about conferences, I'm a person who hates going to professional conferences. There's a few I go to that have a group of individuals who kind of do my same thing. And I tend to enjoy those. I enjoy their companionship and hanging around with them. But some of the bigger conferences, they're horrible. And there's times where you go for a couple months without going to church and you do feel different. And I'm starting to reflect upon this thing. I'm saying, maybe I need to go to those conferences a little bit more, to do a little bit less email, more face-to-face things. So I'm learning through this whole process that might be good for my body, mind, and spirit. What did you take away from this study?
What I took away is that just the power of prayer. Prayer had gotten to be something in my life that that I did as before meals, maybe before bed. It was not something that was really valuable in my life, and I really engaged my faith through a more intellectual process, reading books, talking with others, especially as an editor at Christianity Today. You know, I explored my faith through this mental cognitive process. And I realized that there's much, much more. And one way to get access to that. Well, I should say there are severe limits if you're only engaging cognitively. So I think pastors preaching for 40 minutes or an hour, the effect on your congregation is going to be pretty minimal. When was the last time you heard a sermon and remembered it the following day? It doesn't happen all that often. The limits of our cognitive mind are pretty severe. If we want to be transformed by the renewing of our mind, if we want to be changed into people who are more like Christ, if we want to be people who respond in a tense situation with kindness and love, who respond to conflict with generosity, if we want to be these kinds of people, it doesn't happen because we read a book. It doesn't happen because we thought about it. It happens because we changed who we are. And prayer is one really powerful way to make that possible.
Well, there you have it, Research on Religion, bringing you the research and also some help, self-help advice. My guest today has been Rob Moll. He's the author of What Your Body Knows About God. Rob, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.